I know that we want to talk about the role of faith in where we're at right now with our current relationship with the planet and the climate. But I want to say that one of the things that has been the most sort of like scary, but also just a sense of like, oh, of course, we were always told this was how it was going to happen, has actually been the way that it feels like COVID is written into the Torah narrative of what's going to happen in the situation we're in. All over the Torah, there's this sort of line that talks about how you should give the land a rest, the sabbatical year, a Shemitah year. And there's all these reasons why you should do it and ways that you should do it. And then, of course, later on, the rabbis elucidate tremendously on what that actually means from the Torah. But there's these sections of the Torah that talk about how you should give the land a rest and how you should give it its Shemitah and the theological reason why you should, which is that ultimately you're not, you know, the land has a relationship with God that has nothing to do with you. You're not owners on this land. It doesn't owe you anything. You're stewards or tenants or renters or something on the land might be the right term. But then there's this whole other section that talks about what happens if you don't give the land its Shemitah. And I haven't even been able to pull up the verses and look at them because I think it would just be too scary, honestly. But I know enough to know what it says, which is that, you know, there's these sort of like increasingly horrifying things that happen when you don't give the land its rest, which I take to mean the same thing as extract too much, take too much from it, you know, don't replenish it, throw it out of balance from its natural order with all of its, with all of what we're taking from it, right? And sort of level one is plagues and disease, like horrible plagues and disease. Level one of like what happens when you don't give the land its rest. And it really only escalates to more and more horrifying things from there. When we all went into lockdown, a lot of us from the Jewish environmental world sort of looked at each other and said, are we in Shemitah? What just happened? Did we just land in like the kind of Shemitah you don't want to have, right? There's the Shemitah where you willingly, I plan for a sabbatical year. It's nourished. It's nourishing to me. It's nourishing to the land. It's healthy. And then there's the kind of Shemitah where the land takes it of its own, demands it. And that's not the kind of Shemitah you want to land in. I never thought that Torah words around the land taking a Shemitah would be so literal. And one of the ways I think about the Torah and this particular part of the Torah, which is what I know best, is that it's the story of a people who's gone through, who's either witnessed somebody else's really horrible relationship with land to the point where they've seen all of these things happen, and it's been recorded into the Torah. The ancient Israelites saw the people of the Tigris and Euphrates River like basically make their own land unlivable, right? So saline that they couldn't farm on it or get anything out of it. One approach to thinking about what Torah is it's like a theological response to a people who's watched themselves or another people essentially like make a piece of land unlivable on, like who's gone through a localized version of what we think is happening with climate change. Mm-hmm. I think one of the things, if we're going to talk about faith, that's been amazing for me these past 2 months has been like how bizarrely literal. So much of my life around Torah is about sort of uncovering the layers and the metaphors and like the meanings and the midrash. And I'm like, I think I'm in literal Torah land right now.
I similarly have been feeling that sense of biblical literalness. And I've been thinking about the 10 plagues. For me, it's like, well, maybe now we're all Pharaoh. Like we're all extracting too much from people from the earth. And there's like a roadmap. But for me, then I think, well, then there's redemption at the end of it. Like there's something to come if we take the right steps, if we choose to step into the water or we choose to listen. So I guess that's a long version of saying, like, when you think about what you know about Shemitah and that part of the Torah that you know so well, even in the bad scenario, is there something touching on that idea of uncertainty and fear? Is there some wisdom in there about what happens after?
I know that the people of Israel have a strong role. Pharaoh No, I mean, Moses and Aaron certainly have a strong role in bringing about their own freedom. But also the Pesach story is a lot about like someone else redeeming you, God redeeming you. And that to me feels like a lot of like just having faith, which is what we're talking about, right? In this, in these set of questions you've asked me. I mean, it's always been the case that that is a like life lesson for anybody who wants to call themselves an activist or any kind of ist you want to end with, you know, that there is immediately, as soon as you step into that activist role, you have stepped further out. Like you just stepped out of humility in a way that's, it's so hard to be both an activist and be really truly humble about like not knowing whether your work will make a difference, not knowing, like still wanting to do it, still having hope in doing it, not doing it in a hopeless way, but also being able to say like, it's ultimately out of my hands. It's ultimately not about me. That's such a hard balance to hold. I think what I see in the Shemitah discussion is that unlike the story of leaving Egypt where, yeah, it's like a journey from one kind of reality to another, Shemitah is meant for like a time when you're established on the land and like you're living what one might call normal life, everyday life. And it just sort of, it understands that everyday life where you think that you're not really doing anything all that bad, that even in that situation, there is injustice baked in. There is going to be, because of the nature of who we are and who we are on the land, that there's extraction built in, that there is going to be injustice that builds up over time. All of those societal support structures that we still have today, like feeding the hungry, feeding those in need, sheltering them, they had all of those too. It wasn't like they didn't have that and they needed Shemitah to fix that. It's like they had all of those. They had all their own versions of those. And still, they recognized that there was like a once in 7 year rebalancing that needed to happen. And the rebalancing that they imagined was really radical. It was bizarrely radical. So radical that we think it's not clear if and how much it was ever practiced. Like we think it was practiced some, but we think most of Jewish history, it was not practiced at all. Even when we were like on the land of Israel, you know, where it was supposed to be when this happened. It's like a mystery or like a question to be answered. Like how could one ever achieve a situation in which one could tamp down the economy once every 7 years? Essentially like not in their extraction at the time was like agriculture. Like that was the most extractive thing they had. Now we have much more extractive things even than agriculture, but like essentially not do this very extractive thing of agriculture, let the land reset, give it a year to rewild, rework the norms of society so that everything is considered communal. So like imagine if everything for 1 year was like that.
The commerce happened to communal property.
Everything becomes communal property. Everybody eats the same way. There's all these sort of like leveling agents. Debt is forgiven. That's probably the biggest one, right? So all these like major economic things. So the question is, how would we ever be able to accomplish such a thing? It didn't seem like they've often accomplished it even then. And our economics is much more complicated now than it was then. And the answer seems to be that like you have, it's like a muscle you have to work all the other 6 years. In other words, it has to not feel so weird and strange to make things really communal. It has to feel not so strange or like unusual or radical to think about forgiving debt. It has to not feel, I think that that's certainly these past 2 months, that's where I've put my energy. I've been like, what can we do to grow the idea of the commons? What can we do to grow the idea of shared abundance, of there being enough if everybody could just keep an eye on what they actually need? And I'm really aware of how naive some of this sounds in light of like the greater economic mechanisms that run the world. Like all I know is how to think about this at this very localized level. And if anything, I'm looking for somebody with leadership for how to think about it at a larger level.
I wonder what's there for the witnessing and observing and communicating what could happen that might be instructive or about leadership and what the need of for leadership. Because I also felt that really acutely. You really notice in this time when you have a country with a healthy democracy is in a good state and you have a leader who's caring, then you can ask everyone to do something and they do it. And also there's less suffering because there's more attention to the needs of humans and the planet in that part of the world, those parts of the world. So for me, I guess I'm just left, I'm a little bit with a question mark. What are we learning about what kind of leadership we need? How do we draw on that for people who are stepping out in that space of activists with this crossover from faith communities?
I mean, I honestly feel like I've been waiting 7 years for somebody to tell me. I feel like, you know, ever since I left Teva, I've been like, make me a soldier in your cause or give me my marching orders. And I think that I've been surprised at how hard it's been, how little I've wanted to join with so many, like, again, so many great organizations locally. I don't have to start my own thing. Like, I could have just popped in and been like, okay, I'm part of Climate Action Now. Tell me who I need to call. And how little I've felt that as like the calling, or like when I've went, I've felt like, oh, here I am. I'm doing the right thing. I don't know what I'm waiting for some days. And other days, what I tell myself is kind of like what you said earlier, it's going to be so many of us toiling in such tiny little itty bitty ways that it's never going to feel like we're never going to know if it was helpful or made a difference. Like, I think I've been waiting for someone to be like, this is the thing, do it. This is how it's going to get us where we need to go. And I get these like moments where I'm like, okay, well, that sounds like the right thing. I'll follow that. And then after some amount of time, I'm like, well, I'm not sure this is getting us anywhere. And I don't know whether it's not, or whether I just don't have the composure for it, or whether I'm just middle-aged mom and that's just like, it's just too hard of a time in life to do it. I don't know. But sometimes I think it's not any of those things. And it's just that there's not going to be an MLK for this. There's not going to be charismatic leadership that's going to get us through it. It's just going to be like a million little ants muddling through it until we figure it out. And then not at this like glorious redemption at the other side, but sort of at a...
like a risk mitigation.
Like kind of like at 100,000 deaths after COVID. Like, we all did what we were supposed to. We all did the best we could. Here we are. This is what success looks like right now. Is just not as terrible as it could have been. Like, that's a crazy thing to think about, but like that might be the lesson of our lives, that like success looks like, I mean, for sure, success is going to look like not as horrible as it could have been. And that's like another grief to have to live with and think through. Mm-hmm. And it's hard because it's not, I think, as a faith-based person, I think it's hard because it's not the kind of stories that we have. You know, for those of us who have like, you know, a Zionist background, it's not like, and then we created a new state. It's not like, I survived the Holocaust. It's not like, you know what I mean? It's like, we have so many stories that we hold as like, oh my God. And then this either an actual supernatural miracle happened, or like something that was felt historically miraculous. I don't know that any of those people felt like they were living through, you know what I mean? I don't know if you can feel it, or if it's just the story someone tells about you afterwards, but it may just be that we get a lot of us, that faith is like having faith in tiny little actions and big actions, and having faith that you are not going to understand the big picture. You don't necessarily, it's not marching orders. It's 1,000 little things that you think are kind of the right thing. And you're sort of taking a step in what you think is kind of the right direction, but everybody's a little blindfolded. It's very different than the stories we've been told, you know?
What you're articulating to me resonates so strongly, because the loneliness and disconnection from community in the place where I go to seek community, that has brought me down more than anything, where I feel when I go to the people that are the community that gave me my, who I am, my spirit, my fight, my call for justice, it's given me all this. But it feels so disconnected. I would assume it's really, but hearing you say this is so surprising to me, because I thought, oh, Neely's community, like strengthening. But what you just said about the tool that we have is the concept of a minyan and saying Kaddish and things that require us to be together.
If you're praying for something, it's a lot easier to not be like, I can't do this.
Keeps your soul
focus. It's like the same thing that people know about mantras, you know, like today I will do this, you know, But I think that's what people of faith do. To kind of go back to your original question that you were sent out, I think one very simple act of faith is prayer. Straight, simple.
And communal prayer.
Communal prayer.
Well, this was a gift. Thank you. It was so nice to be able to catch up with you and to have this conversation with you.
It was nice to be able to catch up with you too.